Chapter 8. The Real No Self. One of the most perplexing and potentially off-putting teachings of the Buddha is the teaching of anatta, often translated as no self. In the Pali language, an means without, and atta means self, in the sense of thing, essence, or separate particle. The Buddha taught that there is no thing inside us called a self. This concept is totally counterintuitive. It goes against our ordinary way of thinking. It goes against our normal perception. At best, it would seem to be a rather unsatisfying way to look at things. At worst, it comes off as downright ridiculous. I can still remember the first time I encountered this Buddhist notion. It was in my early teens. Walking through a bookstore somewhere in LA, I picked up a book on Buddhism, randomly opened it to a page, and read a line. It said something like, "All of your problems go back to your belief that you have a self. There is no thing called a self." "Bullshit!" I screamed, mentally, as I slammed the book closed in irritation. Now, 60 years later, I find myself making the same claim I read in the book. Have I drunk the Buddhist Kool-Aid? Well, maybe a little. But it's mostly because I spent some time carefully observing how the perception "I am" arises. Of course, every adult human has a sensory experience of self. If we ask, through which of the sense gates does this perception of self arise, we will see that it arises from a mixture of thought and feeling. Certain kinds of body sensations are more self-referential than others. The touch of our clothes is somewhat related to ourselves, but the body sensations we experience when somebody criticizes or praises us are much more related to the sense of self. They are both body sensations, the touch of our clothes and the feeling that we experience in our body when we are embarrassed in public or when we are praised in public. However, the latter feeling is qualitatively more associated with our sense of individual existence or self. In addition to the body component, there is a self-referential thought, internal conversations and mental pictures that are associated with who you are, what you look like, and so forth. Actually, there are several scales we might use to analyze the experience of our infinite I am-ness. At the broadest scale, we tend to identify with any and all mind-body experience. I am my mental image, mental talk, and body sensation. At the narrowest scale, we tend to identify particularly strongly with self-referential mental image, mental talk, and body sensation. Self-referential mental images are mental images of your own appearance. Self-referential mental talk is your judgment about how cool or uncool you are. Self-referential body sensations are the emotional sensations associated with being praised or blamed. Between the broadest sensory scale of self, I am any and all mind-body states, and the narrowest sensory scale of self, I am self-referential mind-body states, there is a mid-range scale. I am thought plus body emotion. That's the system of mental image, mental talk, and emotional body sensation that I described in Chapter 4. That's the system that my students mostly work with for gaining insight into no self. Of course, any of the three scales can be interesting and productive to work with, and each is, in its own way, natural. Defining the sensory self broadly as any and all mind-body experience is intuitive. Even a child can understand it. On the other hand, working with the self-referential thought and emotion can be both enormously challenging and enormously freeing. There's a reason that I mostly have people work at the middle scale. The reason is that mental image plus mental talk plus body emotion represents a natural system, a system that can be reactive, proactive, interactive, and occasionally inactive. Here's what I mean. When you have the perception of seeing the external world, hearing the external world, and being touched by the external world, the sense of an I that sees externally, hears externally, and feels externally arises because the inner system reacts to those outer stimuli. When the inner system is not reacting to outer stimuli, it may begin to proactively spin memories, plans, and fantasies. Also, it has an interactive mode. A mental image may trigger mental talk or body emotion. Mental talk may trigger a mental image or body emotion. Body emotion can build up until it drives us to form mental images and mental talk. So the system interacts with itself. Is there anything else the system does besides reactivity, proactivity, and interactivity? Yes, it sometimes goes inactive, creating one kind of no-self experience. something that reacts to its environment, proacts to change its internal state, and interacts with itself, constitutes a natural system. It would be convenient to have a name for that system. Let's call it interactivity. Consider for a moment the awesome range of phenomena covered by the rather bland-sounding term interactivity. Memory, plan, fantasy, problem-solving, will, desire, doubt, indecision, confusion, conviction, unpleasant emotion, pleasant emotion, intuition, insight, enlightenment. Enlightenment? Yes, enlightenment is the ability to form a clear see-hear-feel representation of that which precedes each arising of see-hear-feel. Is that all there is to I-amness? Well, yes and no. That's all there is to finite I-amness. But if you look carefully, you'll be able to find what might be referred to as transfinite I-amness, an I-amness that is simultaneously boundlessly large and boundlessly small. Where do you look for that? Well, one way to find that would be to continuously eyeball the I-amness that's behind your I-amness that's behind your I-amness that's behind, until you come to an I-amness that's not limited to mind-body. This is the method called self-inquiry. An alternative approach is to carefully observe the body-mind experience, breaking it into its components, subcomponents, and sub-subcomponents, until you come to the realization that mind-body experience is literally made out of expanding, contracting space. This latter approach is the classical observing practice of Southeast Asia, Vipassana. Although the self-inquiry approach and the analytic observation approach are in some ways different, both of them require and develop concentration power, sensory clarity, and equanimity, and both of them result in an experience of transfinite self. People in the self-enquiry community tend to refer to that experience as the true self, whereas people in the Buddhist community tend to refer to it as no self. But hey, a rose by any other name. When we are unable to keep track of mental image, mental talk, and body emotion as components, they tangle together. Then we get a perception of self as a separate, vulnerable particle, rather than as an interactive, uninhibited wave of personality. The self as particle is a kind of illusion. When thought and feeling become untangled through sensory clarity and decongealed through equanimity, then we get a very different perception of what self is. The somethingness of self and the duality of subject versus object is built into the structure of every human language I'm familiar with. I can't talk about the topic of no self without saying the word I, and every time I say I, I'm using a pronoun, and when I do that, I reinforce the sense that there's a thing called I. It is very confusing, because when people ask questions, the questions are always put into grammatical form, and the answers must also be put into grammatical form. People ask questions like, who gets enlightenment? Who meditates? Who is talking to me now? But the interrogative pronoun who grammatically requires a substantive, a noun, to answer it. To construct a proper response, you have to use this, or it, or he, or she. There is no other way in any human speech to respond grammatically to that question, so the answer always reinforces the illusion. I guess that is why some meditation teachers completely refuse to answer such questions. They just remain silent, or they let out a yell, or utter a seeming non sequitur. For example, the student asks, Master, what is the self? And the master replies, 3 pounds of flax. Getting rid of something that was never there. The sense of self as a separate, vulnerable particle is a kind of illusion that arises when we lose track of inner see-hear-feel activity. There is a good metaphor in the physical world for this type of illusion. If I have two kinds of thread, one white and one red, and I tangle them together and hold them at a distance from you, you get a very clear impression that there is a unified pink mass. If you get closer and view it more carefully, however, what happens to the pink? It seems to disappear. When you clearly see what is actually there, you see the individual red and white threads and no pinkness whatsoever. In the case of self, the analog of pinkness, the property that goes away, is thingness. But we can go further still. In the next step, we penetrate the inner see-hear-feel components themselves, and then we penetrate their subcomponents and their sub-subcomponents. When we scour down into the infrastructure of the thinking mind and the feeling body in this way, we discover their atoms. But their atoms are not things either. Their atoms are a sort of effervescent quantum foam. That opens the door to an understanding of the fundamental substance from which the thought and feeling are constituted, and a new sense of self arises. It is not a self in the ordinary sense of the word. Self in the ordinary sense of the word is an illusion. It is that pink, and the illusion of pink has gone away. The new self is not a noun, it is a verb. It is the activity of personality that arises effortlessly from the nothingness moment by moment. And we might refer to that as a fluid self, or our true self, or big self. But in the Buddhist tradition, we usually choose to call this experience insight into no self. I know this terminology is confusing. The trouble starts when we talk about the pink going away, because that is not exactly correct. The pink was never there to begin with. It's often said that if we practice meditation, we lose our ego, or we get rid of the ego. That is not quite accurate, because we can't get rid of something that was never there. Instead, we simply see the sensory situation as it is. Just because the sense of self as a thing goes away does not for a moment imply that the activity of personality goes away. The enlightened people who constantly talk about no self often have strong charismatic personalities. You might think that's paradoxical, but it is a logical consequence of the experience of no self. It happens because the sense of self as something material has gone away, and all the energy that was bound up in that is now freed up for a fluid expression of personality. We can draw a metaphor from physics. When expressed in conventional units, the equation E equals mc squared implies that a little bit of matter is equivalent to a great deal of energy, because c squared is very large. When someone has seen beyond the illusion of the limited self, a huge amount of energy is freed up for the expression of the personality. That's why people who are deeply enlightened often have expressive personalities. When we talk about the experience of self-consciousness, it usually implies something uncomfortable. When you think about it, that is very strange. Why should self-consciousness be uncomfortable? Look carefully at the experience. What causes the discomfort is holding on to or interfering with the natural flow of self-referential thoughts and feelings, a kind of viscosity within the inner see-hear-feel activity. The self as wave cannot flow smoothly. Once we can experience self in terms of its sensory components, we can then allow those components to arise uninhibited moment by moment. When we do so, our subjective experience of who we are becomes wave-like. Experiencing our inner see-hear-feel self as an effortless activity is extremely fulfilling, but it is also empty and vacuous because it doesn't congeal into a thing. So enlightened people often have expressive, engaging, and charismatic personalities. That's because their internal fluidity manifests as external spontaneity. They possess the doingness of self as opposed to being possessed by the somethingness of self. Encouraged to let go. For many people, the thought of experiencing themselves as not a thing seems like it would be a negative experience. It's just not an attractive idea. It sounds like we are making ourselves and the world into something dead or bleak. At first, I had exactly the same reaction to this concept, but a Japanese Zen master helped me to overcome this fear. Before I tell you how this happened, let me address the importance of having a teacher. There are a couple of reasons why it is difficult to make progress in meditation without a teacher. Usually, we need somebody to inspire us, to answer our questions, and to encourage us. It's not necessary to surrender at the lotus feet of some putative, perfect master. I don't go for that approach myself. But I have noticed that most people make better progress if they have at least one competent coach. We need somebody to encourage us, somebody to work with us, who knows the territory, someone who can speak with experiential confidence, someone we can interact with when we have questions and confusions. Personally, I find the notion of surrendering to a teacher to be off-putting. Moreover, although in some ways it can be a comforting belief, it's been my experience that the notion of a perfect master is a myth, indeed, a potentially pernicious myth. On the other hand, many questions and confusions regarding practice are best addressed through interaction with a competent guide. A competent guide understands how each dimension of human happiness can be addressed through the practice. A competent guide will eventually encourage you to apply your practice to each of those dimensions. By dimensions of happiness, I mean five things: reducing suffering, elevating fulfillment, understanding yourself at all levels, positive behavior change, and manifesting a spirit of love and service. Moreover, a competent guide knows the potential limitations of meditation and will encourage you to supplement your practice with other modalities if needed. Other modalities would include things such as counseling therapy or 12-step programs, for example. In addition to these obvious things, another function that a teacher performs is to exemplify the practice and help us get over certain fears that we might have about where the practice might lead. In my very first interview with Sasaki Roshi over 30 years ago, he blew my mind. He said, "Shinzen, you have been a monk in Japan. You know what this path is about. I expect you to come to the place where you no longer need to make an object of the self or the world ever again." He said this very emphatically, very forcefully. Then he rang his little bell to signal the end of the interview. He had chosen these words carefully. He didn't say, "Come to the place where you no longer make an object out of the self or the world again." He said, "Come to the place where you no longer need to make an object out of the self or world again." He didn't say that I should become incapable of making self or world into an object. He just said that I had to come to the place where I was no longer driven to make an object of self or world. I understood what those carefully considered words were meant to convey. Nonetheless, they really scared the bejesus out of me. I was afraid of the consequences because it sounded to me more or less like being dead. In essence, he was challenging me. "Here is the edge of the Grand Canyon. Jump off." This is one of those situations where having a role model can be really useful. Over the decades, I have had the chance to observe senior Asian masters very carefully. I may not be able to do what they do, but I understand what they are doing. A tennis pro may not be able to do what a world master does, but they can clearly see what a master does. When you watch deeply attained masters, you can tell by the way they move their heads, by the way they carry their bodies, by the way they focus their eyes, that they have no expectation that a world will be there. When they look within, they have no expectation that a mind will be there. Deeply enlightened masters have the body language of Ray Charles, someone totally comfortable with the fact that the world no longer exists as an object. Despite that, indeed because of that, they are incredibly happy, incredibly self-expressive, and incredibly efficacious in influencing the world around them. Contrary to my fear, I had these examples that nothing bad happens if you jump off the edge of the Grand Canyon. Don't fight it. While it's common to find the idea of no self to be off-putting at first, it's also common to become sort of attached to no-self experiences once they start occurring in meditation. When I first became interested in Buddhism, I studied it intellectually at a university. I read a lot about no-self. When I began to actually meditate, I had this idea that I would only be making progress if I were somehow getting rid of the self. On the other hand, if I was aware of having a self, then I thought my meditation was a failure. Without realizing it, I developed an aversion to the natural arising of self. If I was chanting and would lose myself in the chant, I felt that that was good. If I felt myself arising during the chanting, that was bad. This belief tormented me for a long time. Many years ago, I lived at a residence community called the International Buddhist Meditation Center in downtown Los Angeles. Despite the name, it was not required that you meditate in order to be a resident there. Some of its residents were into the practice and others were not. Brian Victoria, a good friend of mine, who also has a lot of experience in Japanese Buddhist monasteries, lived there also. The two of us were really into meditation, and we would lead a sit each morning, and afterward we would chant. Everyone from the house was invited, but relatively few people ever showed up. By the end of these sits, I would often be in a nice, focused place. My samadhi was good. Then we would briefly chant, and that state would get even deeper. I would dissolve into the chanting. I thought that was really great. No self, no problem. At the end of the chant, we would strike a final bell and then briefly savor the morning silence for a magical moment. But inevitably, one of the non-meditators would choose exactly that moment to flush a toilet or slam a door or start a conversation in the stairwell. Immediately my state of no-self would evaporate. In its place arose a spasm of inner activity, a storm of inner see, hear, feel. I was there, goddammit! Why did they have to flush a toilet? Now I am not in the no-self anymore. I really begrudge the arising of this inner activation. I would be mad at myself because I could not stay in no-self. I felt that I had failed, and I was grumpy at whoever had made the noise. I don't know if I would have ever understood how to overcome this aversion, had it not been for my contact with Sasaki Roshi. I started interpreting for him. He would always say, there are two things you must learn. You must learn how to let go of self, and you must learn how to manifest self. I heard that over and over again. He also sometimes said, you want to know what a Zen master is? I'll tell you what a Zen master is. A Zen master is a travel agent. I provide reusable round-trip tickets that allow you to travel effortlessly between heaven and hell. During one of my sanzens, a personal interview with a Zen master, as usual, I gave a totally incorrect answer to my koan. In response, he said something that did not seem related to anything at all. He said, Jesus Christ died and went to heaven, but I prefer to go to hell. And then he rang his bell to signal the end of the interview. Ring, 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 and I left. I had no idea what he was talking about. I just remembered what he said and trusted that eventually it would sink in and make sense. It took years for the metaphoric light bulb to go on, but I eventually understood what he meant. He was showing me where I was stuck in my practice. Let's translate the poetry of a Zen into the prose of Vipassana practice. He was saying something like this. Shinzen, I know you have meditated for a lot of years, and when you sit in the Zendo, you go into some pretty deep states. You really enjoy it when there is an absence of self, which is sort of heavenly for you. But when you grow up, like me, you will relish the opposite of that experience even more. The opposite of the no-self experience is a congealed spasm of inner activity, a subjective Charlie horse, an inner see-hear-feel storm. Because he was a master, he could discern that I was still resisting, still not 100% accepting the arising of the self. He was telling me that when I finally grew up, I would actually come to prefer the arising of the self to the experience of its non-arising. Eventually, I got it. Don't fight this arising of the self overtly, and don't fight it subtly. When it arises, let it arise. Don't resist it. But do try to bring clarity and equanimity to it, because you are going to learn as much from the eruption of self as you learn from the cessation of self. In other words, the quicker and louder you can say yes to each new arising of self, the deeper and clearer will be the no-self state that inevitably follows. If you find yourself in a really nice deep state, and then suddenly you are not in that deep state, it can be upsetting. You may feel like you got tossed out of Eden, and an angel with the fiery sword is preventing you from getting back into paradise. You begrudge the fact that you've been expelled from heaven and flail to get back, but to no avail. But there is something you can do in that place of frustration and agitation. Get on board with nature's program. Totally let the see, hear, feel self arise unimpeded. Don't try to beat it down or regret the fact that it is erupting. Be willing to go back to square one, because it is not really square one. Allow yourself to love and relish the inner see, hear, feel storm. Your job is to clarify it, in both senses of the English word clarify. Something is clear when we know its components, and something is clear when it becomes transparent. There is an intimate link between these two sorts of clarity. Seeing separately and seeing through reinforce each other. Just let the self spasm and give it permission to do so for as long or as short as it wants. And be grateful, not begrudging. You may no longer be in heaven, but you're not in hell either. You're in purgatory. Not necessarily a fun place, but definitely a productive one. No self, the industrial strength version. For me, the most powerful version of no self comes about when you are able to experience your selfhood being loved into and out of existence moment by moment as you go about the activities of your day. I call that the real no self. That may seem like a tall order. Let's take it step by step. It starts by tracking the experience of self in terms of mental image, mental talk, and emotional body sensations. This involves the dimension of clarity that I call resolution, the ability to separate the components and subcomponents of a sensory event. Clarity allows you to track your I am-ness in terms of the same variables that characterize quantified science. How much, of what, when, and where, interacting in what ways, and changing at what rate. In addition to resolution, clarity also involves sensitivity, that is, detection skill. Detection skill is the ability to pick up on subtle sensory events. Just before each conscious mental image arises, there's a spread of subtle subliminal visual thought. Just before each conscious mental sentence arises, there's an analogous spread of subtle auditory thought. Moreover, a local body sensation will often produce a global spread of subtle activation. The ability to detect subtle events is closely related to the ability to detect the instant when something arises, an ability that we might call temporal sensitivity. With time, your ability to detect the absolute beginnings of things will improve. Hopefully, at some point, you'll notice that each moment of self is born as a wave of pure space simultaneously spreading and collapsing. William James famously described the situation of an infant's first sensory experience as a blooming, buzzing confusion. Indeed, it blooms and buzzes, but it's not confusing. It's soothing. The buzz is a kind of creamy effervescence. The blooming is the budding and fading of space itself. This blooming and buzzing is not just the original situation of a newborn child, it's also constantly present in adult life. It's the situation that precedes each conscious moment of selfhood that we experience during the day. But if we are born many times during the course of a typical day, does that mean that we also die many times? Most assuredly. That may sound discouraging, but it's not, not at all. In fact, it's deeply empowering. I call it the power of gone.